you only see the perfection, you see the end result. But maybe it's this whole idea about everyday life, it's imperfections, right? And hard work. So maybe also just to show the behind the scenes.
What does it take to be named Designer of the Year? For Cecilie Maans, it all comes down to what she's always done best: sketching new models, experimenting with new materials, and a carefully curated selection of collaborations. We'll sit down with Denmark's industrial design extraordinaire at Maison et Objet today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Ben Rylan. Also ahead,
I think there's a danger that it can be sort of fetishized, the idea that handmade is automatically somehow superior. I don't believe that at all.
From ceramics to textiles, we'll examine some of the other brands that have got Paris talking. And
what Gucci is doing is actually quite elaborated and quite refreshing. And I love that each of their campaigns have a major theme.
Monocle's luxury correspondent Sagra Mathera de Rosen gives us her verdict on this month's fashion magazines. All that coming up right here on Section D. It feels as though the new year is barely upon us, and yet we're already farewelling January. We'll take a look at how the fashion magazines are forecasting 2018 soon, but first, to Paris, where Maison et Objet, one of the world's leading lifestyle and design shows, is once again underway. This year's Designer of the Year award went to Denmark's Cecilie Maans. Her projects, including a ladder that doubles up as a chair, as well as collaborations with Bang & Olufsen and the Japanese company Actus, have kept the industrial designer's profile on the rise. Cecilie spoke to Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles.
We are at the Maison et Objet, and I was so lucky to be appointed Design of the Year. So we are right now in the exhibition I was allowed to do here.
And there's quite a variety of different objects here. Yes. Is there a consistent theme that runs through them?
I have a red thread in my way of working, and there are some words that I can always put on almost everything I do. And everything is more or less made in the same work method, you could say, starting with sketches, model work. And this is also what I wanted to show here, that it's there are so many task in doing a single piece of design, even though it looks very basic and like nothing, but it's a huge process and it takes a lot of effort and work from our side.
And part of the display is actually highlighting that process. How have you done that?
I see this kind of as a stage, and I even put chairs so you can rest your legs. It's hard to be in a fair. I wanted to display also the things that inspire me in my work, so I took some pieces from my collection and prototypes and one-offs. So it's really a mixture to show the whole scope of my studio, what's happening in my studio in Copenhagen.
So let's maybe wander over and see one of these prototypes. What would you like to show us?
Maybe we could take that chair. That's a prototype of the workshop chair by Muto. It actually got its word workshop chair because it was literally made in our workshop. I have very few sketches of it, of course some initial ones, but very fast we went to the basement where we have the workshop and simply did one-to-one scale model. And before this one there were maybe two or three looking quite horrible, but you got the point, and it's moving you forward. So that's the whole purpose of all these models.
So just looking at the chair and the prototype that we have here, What were the elements of it that made you think this is the one that I'm ready to send to production?
I think the fact that you can walk around it and sense the chair as a whole. Because if you only see it in drawing, then you have the three pictures from the front, from the side and from the top view. And if you do renderings, I don't work with renderings, only for presentations, but not in my work because I can't see the proportions. So it's something about seeing the radiuses and the dimension life and actually also see it with your body. It sounds very corny maybe or tacky, but it's a relationship between you as a person, the body and the object. As well as if it's a spoon, you need to grab it and see, is it too long, is it too short? And we even did this one, we put some blocks of wood underneath so we could actually also test it. That's a huge part of also doing functional pieces.
So in a way we're getting a snapshot of what your workshop's like. Can you give us a little bit of information on that space and how you work there?
It's in the city center of Copenhagen, and I really like to be in the city center, even though the place or the space is quite tight. And it's old shops, so we have smaller shops next to each other, so we are constantly running in the street from one door to another. But we love the space so much, so this is why I'm staying there. And then we divided it into different worlds, you could say. We have one we call the project room. This is where we have all the drawings, and in the basement we have the workshop. And one place is only with computers. One is the meeting room, and then there's my space. Sometimes I need just the tranquility and sit alone and do some thinking and drawing.
You know, you were talking about the importance of actually creating the object and looking at it and, you know, seeing it in its surroundings and, I guess, feeling the vibe of what you've created. Does that same philosophy apply to the smaller stuff? Like if we go over and look at the work you've done with Bang & Olufsen, how do you kind of... Yeah. Think about the human interaction with something on a smaller scale?
It's testing, really. First of all, it's of course, before you even do a single sketch, it's about looking at the situation. Okay, in the case with the P2, the smallest speaker we did so far, we knew it was supposed to be extremely portable, and it should... We found out, okay, maybe it shouldn't have any buttons, because then it will get stuck in your pocket or something. And then testing. Do this one in a model and then put it in a pocket. How is it? Is it nice to have in your pocket? Does it fit in a lady's bag? And so it's really quite basic.
And you've given an indication to the general public here of that process. Mm-hmm. Why is this important for you?
There are so many thoughts behind and so much hard work. And it's maybe also because this whole world of design, you only see the perfection, you see the end result, but you also know when you're getting it back home and you're using it, then it gets scratches, and maybe it's this whole idea about everyday life, it's imperfections, right? And hard work, so maybe also just to show the behind the scenes.
You know, there's obviously a lot of designers here, young designers. Mm-hmm. When they come and view something like this, are they more interested in seeing this prototype chair here with pencil scribbles on it as opposed to the final version? What's the feedback you've had from other designers?
I think actually this chair where you see all the pins, and we left everything, like we just took it from the studio and put it in a big box and sent it here. And I was telling everybody in the studio, do not touch it. Don't correct the pins or anything. It should be original and genuine. And yes, we had great feedback in showing these prototypes.
And, you know, we're here and we're surrounded by so much product and so many people trying to showcase what they're doing. Mm-hmm. For you, do you feel like brands could do a better job or should push harder to translate the process a bit more? Or is it really at the end of the day about showing what is on offer for sale?
I think the main point is that people use effort in doing nice products. And whether it's a short period or a long process, it's just they should really just do their best.
Perhaps let's look at an object that tells a different story for you. Is there anything else you'd like to show us quickly?
Maybe the room divider here. It's wooden panels in solid wood, and it's hinged together with straps of full-grain leather. That's actually it. And then, of course, a lot of nice craftsmanship. And this one was very important for me when I got this invitation. I thought, okay, now is the time I should do this project, because I had it in mind for quite some time. And I thought, okay, now I'll do it. I'll simply just call the carpenter and we will assemble it ourselves and give it a nice oil finish. And again, this is an experiment, but I see no reason why it couldn't go into production. And this is also a nice opportunity to work in this way.
You probably get asked this a lot, but you know, you're from a country that has such a rich history with design and tradition, and obviously you still have strong craftsmanship there. Mm-hmm. But how do you see Danish design going forward, and what's your role in that?
We have a very nice history, and normally I call it's both a gift and a burden to have this strong traditions. But it's also a nice challenge that we also need to see our role in it and also maybe push the manufacturers to actually work with us, because we are alive and we might be the future, because we're also alive in 10 years from now. So this is what we're struggling with. But I think the time is quite nice now in Scandinavia. It's going well. Everything put together makes a nice focus on Scandinavia. So we should just keep doing nice stuff, and then I think it will go well.
The 2018 Designer of the Year, Cecilie Maens, speaking to Monocle's design editor Nolan Giles at Maison & Objet. Let's get some more from Maison now. Monocle's Daphne Karnizes was at the fair and she met two designers of handmade products to help unpick the meaning of this somewhat overused term in the design world.
Meandering the vast halls of the Maison et Objet Design Trade Fair, currently underway in Paris, designers, young and established, seem to favour one word more than others when it comes to showing off their products. Handmade. Hand-loomed fabrics, hand-thrown ceramics, hand-woven rugs, hand-painted and handmade furniture, has it just become a buzzword? I put the question to Eleanor Pritchard, the London-based founder of the eponymous textile studio.
My name is Helena Pritchard and I run a small studio. We do weave designs, so we have two ranges. We have an upholstery range by the meter and then we also make blankets.
And for those that might not know, can you tell us a bit about your background and how the brand started?
I first started making the blankets were the kind of core of the business in the early years. And I guess I've made the first ones probably about 10 years ago. I originally studied history at university, so it's a sort of a bit of a second career. I went back to art college to train in textiles and found that weaving was really the thing that I loved, the mixture of the kind of structure and the pattern, that the design and the pattern and the structure are all one and the same thing. So that's very appealing and I've really stuck with it since.
And as you said, patterns are a big part of your products and your brand. What role does graphic design play?
I think the new ones, to me, are very reminiscent of, I collect a lot of old graph papers, old exercise books. There's a feeling of kind of almost like double entry bookkeeping or something about them. So I think that kind of, with these ones, I think that there's a feeling, as I say, of almost early, different sort of ruled notebook paper type things. I think, you know, obviously the graphic element is very important. But as I was saying earlier, one of the things that I love is that the graphics isn't applied onto the surface. It is the structure. So the pattern is integrated into the way that the blankets are woven.
Tell me about the making side of it. Where does it take place and what methods do you use?
So everything starts in the studio and we start with just a kind of storyboard, lots of visual inspiration. Then the next stage is moving towards drawings, which I do by hand myself. I'm very old school. So they're drawings. And at that stage, I'm starting to think about how they would be constructed. Then we sample in the studio. So nothing gets woven until I've made a hand-woven version of it, because things never turn out exactly as you imagine, and you want to be able to tweak things, just change the proportions, maybe play around with the composition slightly. So we always sample in the studio first, and then when we're happy with the, you know, a sign-off sample, we work with three different mills in the UK. So the new ones are woven in a mill in Lancashire, so they're one of the ones that we're using for a lot of the new blankets. I think there's a danger that it can be sort of fetishized, the idea that handmade is automatically somehow superior. I don't believe that at all. It's more that I think when you can really read in a product that there's an understanding of the process and the material, and there's a skill and a thoughtfulness in there, whether it's made entirely by hand or whether it's something that people have really got to grips with the production process and really kind of understand how something should be made, it shows in the product, I think. There's a sort of an integrity there which really jumps out, I feel.
How's the day been?
We've had a great start. One of the really good things about this show is that we catch up with buyers from all over the world. So we've seen really good stores that we sell within the States and all across Europe. And this is really the one chance in the year for us to just face-to-face meet everybody, say hi. So we've had a great start.
A few stalls down, Dublin-based designer Laura McGahey from Aaron Street East Ceramics says the importance of the handmade lies in preserving old skills and design processes.
For us, it's about the old way of doing things. So each piece is actually hand-thrown on a wheel, so they take a long time to make. I think the maker's hands are seen in each of the pieces. So although we're very precise, or try to be precise about the shapes that we make, they are all different. They are all unique. Each one is bespoke and completely different from the other. I'm Laura McGahey and I'm creative director of Aaron Street East.
And can you just tell our listeners a bit about Aaron Street East, how it came about and your background as well?
Sure. Aaron Street East is a passion project that came about as a result of my interest in architecture and also in the handmade. And I was involved with the Irish Design and Crafts Council and came to see lots of amazing potters making beautiful work. And I had an urge to try and make my own work. So I learned how to throw pots and was kind of obsessed in getting the tessellating shapes, the in and out shapes, which Iron Street East are, I suppose, known for, and developed these shapes. And now we have a team of five potters actually making them, and we're having a really nice response to them. We're based in the fruit and vegetable markets area of Dublin, so the original colours were inspired by the fruit and vegetable colours. So cabbage and potato and pomegranate and pink grapefruit and lemon. And then just this year we've brought out an urban streetscape colour scheme, which is all about verdigris, the copper colour, verdigris, black steel, grey slate, Portland stone. So we're always inspired by what's around us and take that inspiration in the colours, but we like to keep the shapes really simple. I suppose there are different methods of defining handmade, and some people go the whole hog like we do, and then other people have other methods like pouring or casting, and I suppose it depends on how far down the scale you get to being able to say that something is truly handmade. But each of our pieces is unique, and that's important to me actually, that the old skills are kept alive. And we have classes, so we teach twice a month in our premises in our studio, and 12 people come in and they learn how to throw on the wheel, and really they love that connection.
There's an idea that whatever's handmade is automatically superior, but whether something's made entirely by hand should be irrelevant. Skipping machines for traditional making processes helps keep old skills alive and ensures each product is unique in shape and form. But people shouldn't fetishize or overuse the term, then it wouldn't mean much at all. For Monocle in Paris, I'm Daphne Karnizis.
That was Monocle's Daphne Karnizis at Maison et Objet in Paris, speaking to Eleanor Pritchard from the eponymous Woven Design Studio and Laura Magahi from the Irish ceramics brand Aaron Street East. We'll leaf through the fashion pages in a moment, but first, one of the industry's most influential creative minds is on the move this week. Hedi Slimane is taking a seat at Celine, and will lead the brand into menswear, couture, and fragrance. The move has already garnered one fan, with Karl Lagerfeld calling the news enchanting. The Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Get in touch by emailing me, Ben Rylan, on br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Stay tuned. Finally today, we'll take a dive into the fashion pages for a look at how the industry's choicest titles are forecasting their year ahead. Here's Josh Fennett with our luxury correspondent, Sagra Mathera DeRozan.
What we've arranged for our listeners here is a bit of a rundown, the things that they might not have time to read in the fashion press. It's obviously a busy time for the calendar, lots of people away in Pitiuomo looking at the menswear, but we're going to focus today a little bit on womenswear, and you brought in a lovely selection of magazines. I'm going to ask you to talk about them in a second, but my first impression is there's quite a lot of sameness. We've got a copy of Harper's Bazaar from the UK, we've got a copy of UK Vogue, of Elle.
I think it's pretty striking when you see them all together on top of the table, because they're all very pink, very light pink, this kind of sort of chewing gum, millennial pink. So it's like if everyone kind of got the memo on that.
Well, the sad thing is that I feel like if you covered up some of the mastheads, you wouldn't be able to tell which one was which. Do you feel the same?
A little bit the same, yeah. It feels that you have to have like a pre-trained eye in order to know that you're reading one versus another.
And I think at their best, magazines, they can entertain us, of course, but they can kind of shock us and they can show us new things. One criticism of the new Vogue cover is that after Edward Enninfeld's beginning, the promise of diversity on the covers, we have Margot Robbie and we have Nicole Kidman, we have two blonde white women on the Vogue cover. And we see that across the covers. We see some very similar images. Why do you think that
is? They're all blondes, actually.
They are all blondes. But are people playing it safe for January, the publishers, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, January is usually the issue. It's one of the lighter issues in the year. It's a little bit of a prep for what's to come. And I think what we're seeing here is a kind of really light approach, almost introducing the themes of the season, you know, the kind of pastel colors, soft denims, sparkles. It's quite, on one side, it's quite soft feminine look. I mean, then you have another completely different macro trend, which I call kind of the 80s and 90s nostalgia in a way, which is all about all these items that we still have fresh in our memories, whether it's like the bulky trainers or like the, in America, they call them fanny packs. I think here they call them bum bags, which is supposed to be the bag that you must have, or like clear raincoats and bags and shoes. And across all of them, when you look at what are the introduction to the trends for this coming season, they're all very consistent.
So as we delve underneath the covers, you've picked up something very interesting in the form of an advert that you like.
Yeah, I think I would say that's one of the first things that I like to flip through, because I think when you are looking at a number of magazines over time and you look at the advertising, you get a really good sense of what's going on in an industry. I think that the thing that kind of caught my eye first and foremost, and it was in the Bazaar issue, it was like the new campaign, the February issue, the new campaign of Gucci, which is so different from what we are seeing in many of the other brands. There's a certain level of consistency in the kind of look and feel of many of these advertising pages, while Gucci is just, I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful what they have done, and so different. You absolutely know it's a different brand altogether.
I think it's funny when you see the magazines capturing the style of a season, and as you say, talking about pastel colours, talking about slouchier fits, a kind of retro look. And then you get into these beautiful adverts by a Spanish illustrator, Ignacio Monreal. You're kind of in this beautiful fantasy world almost. Yeah. You know, the spread that we're looking at the moment has people wearing masks, swans, very strange images, not quite Dali-esque, but certainly an element of surrealism.
And yeah, being absolutely.
Being very avant-garde. And then if you flip over the page, there's another beautiful Gucci ad with the bag at the centre of it with kind of two mermaids reclining over each other. But compared to the competition, the Saint Laurent advert on the next page, it's so sparse, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very different point of view. And I think that what Gucci is doing is actually quite elaborated and quite refreshing. And I love that each of their campaigns have a major theme.
Another thing you noticed with your very keen eye looking over the magazines was the reintroduction, perhaps, of denim, which I think is an...
Major.
I think it's huge, but it's interesting. There was a news article recently about the closure of the last denim mill in the US. Denim is so archetypally American, but, you know, anything you'll be buying now will be made in Portugal, perhaps Tunisia, Japan, from the salvaged denim mills, which are a bit more premium. Isn't that a funny thing, this American icon leaving America?
Yeah, I think that these other countries have developed great, effective, more modern ways to manufacture. But again, yes, I completely agree with you. And it's a real shame because that was like a jewel, those mills. But I think denim, we're going to see it more and more in accessories. The kind of double denim look, I think, is here. So that's something that we're going to see more and more. I mean, I am actually quite keen to see what happens, for example, with Levi's. I think Levi's, again, on this nostalgia trend for the 80s and 90s, I think it's going to make a huge comeback. And I can tell you that teenagers are now really focusing on Levi's as the fashion jean. I mean, which was not for many years. I mean, there was a lot of niche fashion jean brands. And now I see my daughter and friends of hers that the thing that they want is Levi's jeans. So I think that this, again, fits into with that revival of legendary 90s brands.
Well, I'll be among the very happy people to welcome denim back into the wardrobe. Sadly, it never left mine. We're going to move on to a few other titles in a second, but I just wanted to pick up on one point that you mentioned as well, about how perhaps you felt that a lot of the magazines, as well as looking similar, perhaps having similar emblems on the cover, a lot of the layouts perhaps felt a little bit similar, the roundups, the things you need to buy for the season. Is this because magazine editors have had a bit too long on holiday and didn't put the effort in this January?
No, I just think the January number specifically is a little bit of a formula. I don't know if you can do, as a magazine editor, you can do much more than that, because I think the expectations of the readers are for this type of... So you're going to have the horoscopes, you're going to have what's coming. But even this season, you could see a lot of articles in this, like each magazine had an article about strong women. One was in the city, the other was in the movies. There is an article, the kind of 10 things we love, right? Or 10 key trends. So the structure is a little bit the same in all of them. And I think that's more obvious than ever in a January issue.
Should we move on to the disruptors?
I think yes. I got a couple of wonderful magazines, and I'm going to say something that may be a little bit controversial.
Okay,
here.
Go on, let's hear it.
You know, so we have like ID and Hunger, which is two more, shall we say, off the beaten track fashion titles.
A little bit more youth-focused as well.
You know, they're not monthly, so they have that advantage that they don't have to come up with content all the time. But I was surprised to see how, again, there was a real consistency. And unless you're like a real connoisseur of magazines, they could have blind my eyes, and I might have not been able to say which one was which,
sure,
if you know
okay.
what I mean. Again, it has like a beautiful photography. It's a much more diverse look. This is a phenomenal shoot.
So for our listeners here, Sagra's opened it on an unpredetermined page, and there's a man in a kind of, it looks like a sort of plasticky, inflated spacesuit come suit of armour. Again, the metals that you're talking about, such vibrancy, very simple backdrop, a little play with shadows and light, but the clothes are really popping off the page.
And I think the model is remarkable because you can tell that is a chap with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
Which I think is absolutely wonderful. And then you have a much more varied assortment, you know, of looks and faces and moods. So I think that this is a wonderful, wonderful example of, you know, and very artistic as well. I mean, some of these images, I feel that I want to kind of tear and put them in a frame.
So Sagra, as a luxury market watcher and as someone who knows the industry extremely well, people are often a bit confused by January. There's so much going on. There's so much fashion to look out for. Can you maybe point them to a magazine or a title, or it could even be a website that you go to for a bit of inside news, a bit of inside gossip? Or do you have to read them all to get the scoop?
I happen to be quite the addict, so I read them all, as opposed to I don't get the scoop from anywhere. But I do think that Bazaar is one of those magazines that I tend to pick up. I think it's a very nice, accessible, yet with a touch of sophistication. You know, anybody can read Bazaar and kind of get the points. I think also it's quite broad in terms of age range. You don't feel that you're reading something that is like super young or super old. Vogue, obviously, is a classic, you know, and I think that now we're all looking at what's happening next. You know, the first issue was like a wow. I think that this January was a little bit more...
You pulled a face there, which would be indiscernible to listeners. Maybe we could talk about that just very briefly. I think Edward Enningfell's first issue, people really felt like there was a moment where you needed to go out and own that magazine, didn't they? They really felt like you needed to know what was happening. And being a magazine editor isn't a job that you have for a month. It's the job that you have for years, hopefully.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, you know, going back to a perhaps less diverse cover image, does that mean anything to you? Does that mean the magazine's any less interesting? Or
things could have been pushed a little bit more without losing the essence of Vogue. That's my sense, right? We're still looking at the same things. And this was like a major opportunity for a very different person to kind of run this mega iconic title. And yes, you can see some changes, definitely. But I think that I kind of wanted to be witness to bigger changes somehow.
Sagra Mathera-DeRozan there with Josh Fennett. Next week, as internet giants reshape our retail landscape, we'll look at some of the ways technology is impacting design.
The interesting thing about the design of technology and how it radiates into other products is it's always at its best when there's form and function fused together perfectly.
Section D was researched by Daphne Karnizes and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Ben Rylan. Bye for now.